You're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com.
This is episode 12 of the Short Story Geeks podcast for October 5th, 2011, with your hosts, The Neech, Buck Turner, and Graveyard Greg. Sponsored by Fur Planet. Explore a world of furry fun at furplanet.com. Hello, and welcome to episode 12 of the Short Story Geeks podcast. I am The Neech, and with me I have...
This is Buck Turner.
And I am Graveyard Greg.
We apologize for the gap in the show last week. Our old nemesis schedule conflicts came along and knocked us off, but we're going to make it up by having another episode next week, so you'll get two in rapid succession.
Yeah, and next week's going to be Lucky 13.
Ooh.
I'm going to look forward to that one.
Should have a good theme for that one.
Well, we can do like all horror stories. We're going to be having Halloween come up. Anyway, for the headlines, we only have one headline this week, which is that Neil Gaiman is doing a short story tweet-a-thon. This has been reported in The Guardian and a few other places. Basically, there's a BBC4 program about short stories. You know, it's like a dramatization of short stories that has been perennially threatened with cancellation and like officially canceled. And like Star Trek, before it, it's had a bunch of fans screaming and yelling bloody murder because they don't want it canceled. One of those fans is Neil Gaiman, and when Neil Gaiman screams bloody murder about something, you know, Britain takes notice. So what he's doing is he is doing a tweet-a-thon, which is just little short stories in the form of tweets on Twitter. It's going to be going for another week and a half. He was doing it for 5 weeks, but this actually happened 3 weeks ago, so we've got a couple more of these going on. So if you're on Twitter and you follow Neil Gaiman, and if you're on Twitter, you should be following Neil Gaiman, because everybody on Twitter follows Neil Gaiman, except, you know, the people who are too busy following Will Wheaton, you'll want to check this out. Anyway, on to the discussion.
Hello, listeners. How are you? Fantastic. Because you're listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com. I'm wearing a headset.
Not actually Isaiah Mustafa. Isaiah Mustafa's fees are way out of our budget. Void where prohibited.
For discussion this week, my story is in a special issue of The Atlantic magazine. They did an issue on short fiction. It's just like a little fiction anthology issue, which is on the newsstands now. I got this at Barnes & Noble just a week ago, I think it was. And the story is The Last Copy by Ariel Dorfman. This story, it's more of a literary kind of story than the sort of geeky fare that we tend to do here. I thought it was particularly interesting because it's about a writer. He's actually a copy editor most of the time, but he wrote a book, didn't really think it was publishable, so he took it to a vanity press, had 1,000 copies printed up. Then one day, as he's riding along the train, he realizes that one of the things in the story is going to reveal a truth about something he's done in his past that he doesn't want a particular person to find out, and he's frantically worried that she's going to come upon this book and read it. This particular person, this woman that he doesn't want to find out what happened in the past, is like the only person whose opinion he really cares about, and he feels really guilty about this thing that happened, and he's like, why the heck did I put it in this story? So he decides he has to go and find every copy of this book and keep her from reading it. So the story is all about him tracking down all the copies of this book so that she'll never see it. I'm just going to read a little bit of it here. Oh my God, she would know. As soon as she'd read the book, she'd know that he'd lied to her. The revelation came to Antonio on the train, exactly at midpoint between Siena and Firenze, as if some new part of his brain wanted him to understand how hopeless his situation was, suspended between two cities, not knowing whether to hurry forward to Firenze to make sure the publisher did not send out more copies, or backward to Siena to visit every one of his friends and also the local critics scattered around Tuscany to rescue every last book out there. Why did he care? He did. He hadn't seen her in 20 years, but every morning when he awoke, the first thing he thought of was her, awakening at that same time. He imagined Griselia in her nun's cell. He imagined her imagining him. She nursed the only image of Antonio that he wanted to kept unbroken somewhere in the world. He derived an inordinate amount of comfort from that idea, that somebody thought well of him, that he had a brilliant destiny ahead of him. Even if her image of his decency was fraudulent, a falsified memory, one that had persisted only in her head, belied by his drab, gray, lonely life, and by what had really been corroding his mind that night long ago. So that's the basic premise of this story, and I think it's an interesting tale because it turns this sort of normal authorial situation on its head. You know, most authors, particularly if they've done something with a vanity press, are all about trying to come up with ways of getting people to read it. And this author instead is trying frantically to come up with ways to keep people from reading it. And there's a lot of entertaining vignettes. He meets an old critic who he's had run-ins with, and he finds a woman who really likes the book and wants to keep reading it, etc. So it's entertaining.
Yeah, it sounds like a neat premise for a book, for a story.
It also sounds kind of expensive, getting all those copies.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the things he's like, you know what? I spent a lot of money on this book. I'm going to spend even more money to keep anybody from reading it. Greg, what have you got?
I discovered this author on Twitter. I think it was a retweet from one of my other friends. He was tweeting the fact that he had a short story for free on Smashwords, and I'm a big supporter of Smashwords, so I thought I would check this story out.
Yeah, big supporter of free stories.
And because of this, I mentioned to him that I will read this short story, and if I like it, I will review it on our podcast. So now he's watching our podcast on Twitter, and so hopefully we have a new fan.
Hooray.
The gentleman that I am speaking of is Mark Sousa. I hope I pronounced his name correctly. And his story is Cupid's Maze. The draw of this was it's a horror story. And the other draw, it was absolutely free. So I was able to test drive it on my new Kindle. Thank you, Alex Vance. And the description is, it's a short story. Sean has popped the question and dreads the drive across the bleak Kansas landscape on Valentine's Day to announce his intentions to his fiancée Janet's parents. When he sees a sign for a corn maze, he pulls in for a momentary reprieve. Little does he know what a mistake he's made. Like it says, they find a corn maze and they decide, you know, on a whim, they're going to go in there. They even get a map and everything, and then they go into the corn maze. After a few moments, maybe a few minutes, they realize that the map isn't very accurate, so they get rid of it, and then they start realizing, where's all the noise? There's cars in front of this corn maze. Shouldn't there be people? Shouldn't there be people talking and laughing? Janet, you know, blows it off as, you know, it's a corn maze, and, you know, sounds get muffled. But even if the sounds were muffled, you'd be able to hear things. Eventually, they are completely and totally lost, so they decide they are just going to go right through the corn stalks. They're going to, you know, disregard the entire maze, and that's when they find a rope trap, or what they think is a rope trap. It is a strand of white thread. It's very sticky, and after a while, they manage to remove it from Sean's leg, and as they go on, they decide that, you know, they notice there's a lot of these rope traps. So they bend over the stalks to walk over them, and somehow Sean is able to touch one of the strands, even though it's sticky, and it's pulsing, as if it has a pulse, if I'm to understand this correctly. That's when it gets really weird, and Janet is drugged away by something. He doesn't get a good look at it, and you'll have to read the ending for yourself, because I'm not about to spoil it, but it is a horror story. It reminded me a lot of Stephen King in that he never describes exactly what you see. He saw it out of the corner of his eye, and, you know, he lets the mind just go crazy with what it could be. It's as big as a human, big as a St. Bernard, not sure. But there's something going on in that corn maze, and it's a free short story. Cupid's Maze by Mark Sousa. There's a link to it in the show notes. I highly recommend it.
It sounds interesting.
And what is it about corn mazes that's so dang creepy anyway?
Well, according to the afterword, it's based on a story in which he had just proposed to his fiancée. They went into a corn maze. The map was just totally useless, and he went from there.
So I would expect the map of a maze to be misleading on purpose. I mean, isn't that the point of a maze, that figure it out?
Well, some people just don't like to have any fun. I guess that's why they do have those maps.
All right. Well, Buck, what have you got?
Well, completely coincidentally, I was at the library paging through the short story search in their card catalog electronically, and I came across a number of interesting things. One of the ones I picked up was Neil Gaiman's book, Fragile Things, a collection of short fiction and wonders. And, you know, gone through, read a couple of the stories that are all very interesting, but one in particular, actually even one of the first ones, grabbed my attention, and that is A Study in Emerald. In the introduction, Neil Gaiman talks a little bit about each of the works, and he has to say that this particular one was requested by an editor for an anthology that was combining the world of Sherlock Holmes with that of Lovecraft and the Cthulhu mythos. And
I think I've seen
it was
that
something,
anthology, actually.
Something that Neil didn't really think had a lot of potential at first. Instead of thinking of it as kind of the chocolate and the peanut butter going together, thought of it more of like the oil and the vinegar, that those two things really don't mesh well when you figure the intense rationality of Sherlock Holmes versus the intense madness of a Lovecraft story.
Well, I mean, Lovecraft's work is, well, it's not exactly scientific, it's pseudoscientific. It's science fiction in nature, so I think there's a definite, I guess not exactly synthesis, but more of a
certain amount of synergy.
Yeah, a contrast that works. You know, what's the musical term where you have
harmony?
A melody and a counter melody going.
Counterpoint.
On. Yeah, I think there's something where that could really work.
Well, Neil really did turn this into something pretty special. He did win a Hugo for it, and it really, if you're familiar with Sherlock Holmes. Rather closely familiar. You may remember A Study in Scarlet, which was the first Sherlock Holmes story. It tells the meeting of Watson and Holmes. A Study in Emerald kind of plays on that. They never quite come out and call it Sherlock Holmes. They never quite come out and say too terribly much about the old ones. But at the same time, it's a sort of subtle twisting of A Study in Scarlet, assuming that the old ones had come up from the sea and started ruling the earth as royalty. And it's actually really intriguing the way they take a lot of the elements from that original Study in Scarlet, you know, kind of the play between Watson and Holmes, the way that they go through in the various guises, the clues are very similar to A Study in Scarlet in terms of, there's a big, the point of, you know, Holmes recognizing a certain type of tobacco ash and, you know, understanding all of these forensic aspects of the, you know, the particular murder that was done, you know, master of disguise, all of that other thing. And then really kind of subtly, not so subtly, but altered and twisted by the servitude, the reverence towards the old ones, which are, you know, essentially ruling the world at this point.
Okay.
This sounds like a very... It sounds like, you know, something Alan Moore would do with his League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. It sounds very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't explicitly mentioned for this one, I believe, but it was something he is very familiar with, of course, given his background.
Yeah,
he did mention...
whole comics.
He did mention the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen in his introduction to the anthology as being one of the big influences that he's had over the years, that kind of blending of two different or multiple different fictitious worlds.
Cool. Okay, well, we're going to go on to the bloody pen of the ranting editor.
Listening to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com has been clinically proven to make you smarter and more attractive. That's shortstorygeeks.com.
Not actually clinically proven. May cause confusion or spontaneous fits of giggling. Void where prohibited.
The bloody pen of the ranting editor!
Okay, and this week, in terms of the bloody pen of the ranting editor, I wanted to talk a little bit about making decisions. Seeing as how I've got a number of difficult decisions that I've been somewhat putting off a little bit too long that I need to start buckling down and making, wanted to kind of look at making decisions in your own fiction, in the world, in how you craft a story. And I think one of the more difficult things to do as a writer is to have your characters make decisions, and especially to have your characters make decisions that are different than the decisions that you yourself would make in that situation. It's something that's very easy to do, is to really put a lot of yourself into a story, to make the characters make decisions that you would make, that you support. But it's really another thing to move beyond that and to create characters that make decisions that are consistent within themselves, that don't come across as bizarre or strange out there in terms of the character that you've established, but that are very different than your own. And that's really something that's very important to do, given that most people have, you know, at least a certain amount of rational impulses. They want to have things come out for the best. They want their characters to come out for the best. They don't want to kind of needlessly and pointlessly torture their characters, and they don't want their characters to necessarily be bad people. So they want to kind of make a character that's very consistent with their own particular moral leanings. But at the same time, you know, for a few stories, that's fine. That's all well and good. And there are authors who certainly make a career out of, you know, writing those characters that are very consistent with what they themselves would do. But it's really ultimately very limiting. And it can, you can find yourself caught in a trap of always having the same types of characters, making the same types of choices. And that's, it's well and good to have a really well-crafted character who you know how they would make their decisions. Someone like Harry Dresden, after 7 or 8 books, when, you know, Jim Butcher sets up a plot point, I can, you know, guess with fairly high accuracy how Harry Dresden is going to react to that particular plot point, you know, which is very important for a long-running established character to have that sort of consistency and consistency of character. At the same time, it can get a bit tiring if every book that you write or every book that, you know, you put out or every short story that you put out is covered or is full of these same characters making these same choices. So it's important to kind of move beyond and figure out how to create a character, you know, who makes choices different than you think they should be made. It's a bit of a risk. It can come off as inauthentic if you aren't careful with it, but it's really something that needs to happen to, you know, number one, create more intense conflict in your stories. You have to have your characters making a certain amount of questionable decisions to set up conflict in your story. And it also, you know, yes, it can lose some readers to have very different story types, but it can also keep your readers from becoming kind of bored and moving on from your particular stories if they're always the same thing, very predictable. So that is definitely something that you need to be aware of when you're making decisions. And of course, there are the wider decisions, you know, setting, themes, that you want to vary those up as well. But for today, I think that's enough in terms of looking at what character decisions are being made by your characters and how do they relate to the rest of the story, their character as a whole, and the last 5 stories that you've written. Are you doing something new and different? Or are you doing more of the same old, same old?
Well, I remember Jim Butcher interview speaking of Harry Dresden last week. He talked about each story he did, he tried to come up with something that he didn't quite think that he could pull off, and write that. And I think that's a case where if you find yourself getting into a rut because you're having characters do the same stuff all the time, that's the kind of thing where you can look at it and say, how can I switch up? How can I do things differently this time? But also, there's another side of this problem is the whole concept of the idiot ball.
Oh, yes.
Which is something where what you said about it seeming inauthentic. The idiot ball is from TV Tropes, and actually it was from a particular TV series. I think it was Herman's Head. The writer would say, okay, who's carrying the idiot ball this week? Meaning, which character is going to do the stupid thing that makes the plot move forward?
I like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, every sitcom that ever existed has had its idiot ball moments, and that's where you have the character, you know, is in a jam, and the best thing to do would be to come clean and just fix it all. But that would end the show after 5 minutes, so of course they dig themselves further and further into the hole. That kind of thing. You know, anything where you have a situation where a reasonable person would say, okay, stop, this is stupid, let's do something else instead, but they don't, that means they're carrying the idiot ball. So that's the sort of the opposite side of making your character do decisions that are not necessarily what you would do. You have to make sure that it is a decision that flows naturally out of that character.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so.
If it's, you know, you have to go down into the dark attic that you know the monster is down in because otherwise the story doesn't happen, that's not a good way of making your choice.
That would be a terrible way of making choices. You don't go down to an attic, you go up to an attic.
Well,
sorry, couldn't resist.
That too, yes. Well, I have friends who have storage in the basement they call the attic, so I have this...
You have strange friends, then.
I do have very strange friends. We've mentioned that
yes,
before.
Yes, and aren't you one of them, Greg?
No. I've been secretly trying to sabotage Elite for a while. Do you know how long it took me to get him to cancel Suburban Jungle?
Yeah. Well, you know, you keep your friends close, and you keep your enemies closer, and you keep Graveyard Greg on a tight leash. But anyway...
As long as you give me that studded little collar, I love.
Yep.
Yeah, and really, I think, Nietzsche, you hit upon it, is that you don't want your characters to necessarily be carrying an idiot ball. You want them to be making choices that, for that character, make sense. For that character, seem rational.
Yeah.
For that character's point of view, they aren't doing something stupid. They're doing something that works for them. And if that is the case, you know, your audience may want to punch that character right in the face, but in a way that's a success. It means you've made something about that character resonate with people. Negatively, true, but, you know, provoking emotion.
Nobody's perfect.
I mean, you don't necessarily want them to punch him in the face, 'cause, oh, they're making such stupid decisions all the time. Why do they never learn anything? But you want them to make decisions where it's like, okay, based on what this character has seen, what they've done in the past, what has worked for them before, I can see why they're doing this horrible, horrible thing instead of doing the quote-unquote right thing that I want them to do.
Yeah.
That kind of keeps the story moving, but it keeps you from, you know, my friends and I have had this discussion recently in terms of TV about, you know, the Torchwood miniseries that just concluded, that after everything, it was like, okay, who had the idiot all this time? And then everybody says, oh yeah, so-and-so is just, you know, who was writing that character? How they didn't act anything like they did in the last episode.
Yeah.
You don't want your reader to be doing that same thing to you, you know, the moment you finish a story and it says, wait, that character at the beginning, you said they were, you know, this one type of person, and they surely weren't based on their choices. Got to be, you know, make a consistent kind of narrative and feel for it.
And that is where the editor comes into play. The editor can help.
Or again, the beta reader or whomever.
Beta reader, first readers, whatever you want to call it. Idiot ball, huh? I like that. I'm going to have to use that one.
I used the idiot ball a few times myself in Never Never particularly, but that was a comic strip, you know, and there's a certain amount of flexibility that you have in a comic strip that you don't have.
It's the comic strip.
Anyway, I think we're going to go on from here to the end show.
Ooh.
The Daleks command that you listen to the Short Story Geeks podcast at shortstorygeeks.com. Obey the Daleks. Obey! Obey!
Well, my little plug this week is give you a little bit of background information about it. At conventions, one of the things I have at my table are just little buttons.
And they are very wonderful buttons.
Oh, well, thank you
very
much.
Just thought I'd let you know that.
Well, that's always appreciated. But anyway, one of the buttons that I've carried for a few years now is the button of Charisma Plus 2, which is a little gaming joke. You know, it fits in the body slot, so it's good for sorcerers. However, I decided this year that I wanted to change it up, and so I've upgraded to the Button of Charisma Plus 4, which makes you 20% cooler. And this is a variation on the Button of Charisma Plus 2. Instead of stark black and white, it has bright rainbow colors, so it's nice and shiny.
But do they stack?
They do not stack with each other, but it is an untyped bonus, so it will stack with other charisma bumps. So if you have, like, a Cloak of Charisma, it will stack with that. Anyway, that is my plug. You can get it from Gnome Co. Publications, where my books, etc., are also for sale, and I will have it at further confusion.
I would just like to say, you know, and if you, like me, don't care about this MLP stuff, you could just, if you're gay, it's a rainbow. Come on, people.
Yes, it does make you fabulous. So.
It does make you fabulous, people. Come on, you know you want it. I think it's my turn now.
It is your turn.
Speaking of further confusion, I'm going to just deal with one thing, although I would like to mention, hopefully Carpe Diem will come back this week. Yes, I know it was supposed to come back last week, but Red Cam doesn't know how to read a calendar, you know. But I am going to be releasing my first novel, Welcome to Cappuccinos, at Further Confusion. Hooray! Today someone drew an alternate cover for me just as a joke. I loved it so much, I am going to be announcing it as the Further Confusion edition of Welcome to Cappuccinos. There will be a link in the show notes. It's just so adorable. Yes. So
it is very cute.
It's
like
cute.
This Johnny Bravo
Johnny
version
Bravo
of
retro
character.
Criterion Collection kind of deal. I am just completely in love with it. So there you go. It'll be at Further Confusion along with the regular edition. And dare I say it, could there be a chibi edition? I don't know. We'll have to see. It will make you 20% cooler. And it will stack with the Button of Charisma Plus 4. Maybe.
Maybe. All right. Buck, what have you got?
All right. I've gotten something. This is a question I've gotten off of Twitter the other day. Is somebody wondering if I had gotten enough submissions for Roar? I have. So that means that for the moment, the Roar submission pile is going to be closed. This is kind of tying back to the decision-making. I've got some decisions that I need to be making, and we'll be kind of communicating out to those people who submitted over the next couple of days, a week or so, about who I was selecting to be in the next volume of Roar and the work that will be done on that next volume of Roar. As an alternate note, I am also going to be headed to Oklacon about 2 weeks from now, so if you, like me, will be completely cut off from technology for that particular weekend, feel free to come up, say hi. It is outdoors in Oklahoma. There is no cell phone, so no Twitter, no web, no email.
How will you survive?
I don't know.
More concerned, isn't it like going to be getting cold really soon? Because, I mean, I know down here in Reno, we're talking about 45 degrees on Wednesday, and that's like, what?
Yeah, so, it was freezing here. It was only like 80 degrees.
Okay, so but that's
really cold.
Exactly.
Really cold.
Because like yesterday was like maybe 75 degrees.
I mean, there's talk that it might get down to like the 60s tonight, which is somewhat terrifying.
It is very terrifying. I mean, yesterday, like I said, yesterday or the day before, we actually had rain. Didn't know what to do.
What's that?
Well, Oklahoma's a little further north than you guys currently.
Exactly.
That is something where it might be an issue.
Yeah. So remember, if you're going to Oklahoma, Buck, be sure to dress in something called layers. Bring a coat with you.
Perhaps a sleeping bag or a blanket.
Well, I think that goes without saying. I'm talking about when he's not sleeping. Bring something called a coat. It's not a shirt. You should also wear it with a shirt.
Moving on. Let us talk about our sponsors, Fur Planet.
Yay, Fur Planet. After you, Buck. You first.
Okay. All right. Well, Fur Planet, they were just actually last weekend up in the Pacific Northwest at Rainforest. I do know that they brought out a brand new product there that most of our listeners are probably going to be pretty interested in. There is a new Kyle Gold novella that is out. It's available. I think it's still in the quote-unquote pre-order status. They've been having some family issues, so they haven't been as up on the business side of things while they get, you know, through that rough spot. But it is a new Kyle Gold novella called Science Friction. It is part of their Cupcakes line of novellas, so it's a pretty easy, inexpensive thing to pick up, and it is on the naughty side for those of you who enjoy that. So that is definitely something to check out, and they've got, I know, another several items that are kind of waiting in the wings to be brought out that are brand new. Of course, they've got an extensive back catalog, including Fang and Roar, among many, many other fine comics and novels.
Speaking of comics and novels, yes, Fur Planet also will be publishing Dungeons and Denizens Volume 4, which I think John the Leech Robey is going to get a big freaking kick out of, considering it will cover the Yebor storyline.
I love Yebor. Yebor is so awesome.
I had no idea I was going to enjoy working on Yebor, but that's beside the point. But yes, Fur Planet, they're going to publish Welcome to Cappuccinos, and Buck pretty much covered everything. Thanks a lot, Buck.
You're welcome.
Hopefully they will also publish Fang Volume 4, which will inevitably come out, which wasn't supposed to come out in Anthrocon. I think we could just blame Alex Vance for that one. Or the Nate. We'll just blame you, Nate.
I had nothing to do with it. I was
exactly
in another state.
That's why we can blame you.
Oh, okay. So that's Fur Planet. They're awesome. They're our sponsors. We love them, and you should too. Let's see, what else we got? We have our usual call for audience participation, suggestions, news items, general plugs. If you have anything you'd like us to talk about, or any stories you would like us to cover, or just any kind of feedback at all, you can leave a comment on the website, or you can email us directly. I am theneech@gmail.com. We've also got Greg and Buck, what are your email addresses?
Well, I am graveyardgreg@gmail.com, and if you want to talk about my, make me use my real voice, hey, come on, let's hear something.
All right, and I am Buck C. Turner at baddogbooks.com, also on Twitter as @editorbuck.
All right, and you can subscribe to us via the RSS feed, which is floating in the magic coffee cup of doom on the website, or on iTunes. We are on either place. You can follow the podcast Twitter account as @shortstorygeeks. So come back in 1 week. Our next show will be on October 12th. And do we have a sign-off?
I heard something about a short story, but I would be paraphrasing it. A short story is like a woman's skirt, long enough to cover the legs, but short enough to tantalize. Not that I would know anything about that.
Okay, sure.
Sure, why not?
We'll go with that.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
This has been episode 12 of the Short Story Geeks podcast, sponsored by FurPlanet.com, with your hosts The Neech, Buck Turner, and Graveyard Greg, with additional material by Laurie Robey. Intro and outro music provided by the Rat City Brass at ratcitybrass.com. Incidental music provided by freemusicarchive.org and the PodSafe Music Network at musicalley.com. All music used with permission under the Creative Commons license were by its creator. Thanks for listening. Wow, you were really ganging it up there, Greg.
I felt like ganging it up there. It's a beautiful day outside, and you can just delete the part about the voice because I thought I was going to get a laugh out of one of you, but neither one of you laughed.